the vault of startling monster horror tales of terror.
Hello, my fellow morbid motorheads. I was just taking my old jalopy, Cryptine, to get fueled up. Oh, don't fret, fiends. The old Chris Keeper is environmentally friendly. Old Cryptine here is a hybrid car. She runs on a combination of baby seal blood and the tears of children. So it's off to the aquarium with me. Come on, take a ride with me. You can listen to the latest podcast where I'm joined by El Jacone and the Hair Metal Hero as we discuss a film that you will automatically recognize as one of John Carpenter's best.
All right, we're back with John Carpenter's Cryptine, and El Jacone, I think that was your idea last time, and I think it was a great idea.
Well, thanks for the milk.
I haven't seen this one since it came out, and I think I liked it better now than when I first saw it.
I had last watched Cryptine before this. Oh, geez, probably about 8 or 9 years ago. I rented it with my wife, who was then just my girlfriend, because I was reading the book. So I thought it'd be good to watch the movie. And I tell you what, I really enjoyed it too. I hadn't seen it in a number of years. This is the one that a lot of people forget about when you're talking about John Carpenter's films, but it definitely worth watching them.
Yeah,
and the heroes. Oh.
Yeah,
the rumors of my death have been greatly exaggerated. When I started first really getting into Carpenter and trying to go back through his entire, Jesus Christ, I can't talk to that guy. Was it resume? There we go. That's the word. Went back through his resume. I said to myself, I didn't see this one, so I picked it up and surprised by. It's very much an 80s movie, but it does carry that 50s vibe through it, which is kind of interesting. And it's a well made little film. I mean, it's not going to reach out and grab you by the balls, but what it's trying to accomplish, it does it well. So it's been a joy to review that a few times over the past few years.
And you know what's interesting, Hero? You say that it has it's definitely an 80s movie, but it's got the 50s vibe. But what's interesting is that like the novel, this is set in 1978. So
yeah.
it's got an 80s movie vibe. It's got a lot of 50s vibe, but at the same time, it's got that kind of idyllic 70s vibe to it. You know, which in Carpenter, I would say that pre-Reagan feeling to it. That it touches a lot of different eras, and it does them all pretty well, because even though it's the 80s, it's a pretty good representation of the 70s too.
It is, and it's funny, and it's and you've got your the Jock character, he's got his 50s style varsity jacket, and he even has a very 50s style haircut, because he's a jock, so he's got short hair, and his best friend doesn't look very 70s either, because he's a super nerd. He looks like a nerd in the 70s. So you don't have that sort of, now when we see a 70s film, everybody's sort of shaggy and everything, but this was small town USA in the 70s. It wasn't quite as shaggy, and the characters, well, the shaggy characters in this were all the heavies, the bullies and the
hoodlums, yeah.
And the hoodlums.
Yeah, and even Lee, Lee is, she's what do they say? She's she's got the face of a goddess and the body of a slut, but she's dressed very conservatively throughout the film. She's a very beautiful young lady, but she's not that typical what you expect, like that 70s the Daisy Dukes and halter top sort of cliche.
No, she's sort of got the John Carpenter's 80s hair, which he always likes, even to the, you know, even past the 80s, he's always like that hair on the ladies.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is. It's a mishmash of all different kinds of. One thing that I really liked that was really funny is the coarseness of the language. That's something that was a big carryover from the book, and that was something in the 70s, especially. You know, just, you know, people are calling each other. You know, generally, you know, teenagers, especially teenage boys, are, you know, really rude around each other. And this had the coarseness of teenage boys and the coarseness of, you know, mechanics, car, you know, the old car guys who had a different, you know, nothing smells better than the smell of new cars, maybe for pussy, which was like the greatest line. And when that movie came out, that was the line that everybody picked up on in my high school anyway.
Yeah.
In my circle of friends. And then what was really funny is at the one point, one of the lines, it was TTFN, which was ta-ta for now, which was really funny because it sounds very modern. It's like, you know, LM, or, you know, LMFAO or any of the internet sort of short things. And it's funny that stuff existed then, but it was purely an oral, you know, thing passed on.
Yeah,
and douchebag. They use the word douchebag a lot. Yeah. That's one that's come back into the common vernacular now.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're talking about you know, the '50s, the '70s, the '80s. One thing that was also interesting is that when I didn't think about this until I was watching it this time, but you know, something that is, you know, that Carpenter looks at a lot of times, especially in his films that are set in these smaller towns, is. The story's kind of a riff on classic Americana, which isn't surprising considering that this is an adaptation of King. And Stephen King, a lot of his whole motif is a riff on classic Americana. And I connected that thematically for Carpenter with Halloween. You know, it's a very traditional sort of American, you know, idea to go on trick-or-treating, dressing up in costume and scaring people on Halloween. And by the same token, what's Christine ultimately about? It's a story about a boy in his car. You know, a very classic sort of American motif. Of course, you know, it kind of gets turned on its ear because it is, again, King and Carpenter. But it still taps into that sort of root American vibe. That,
being cool.
Yeah, the coolness, yeah.
Sunglasses and black leather jacket and rock and roll. You know, and that very American theme, especially in movies and American entertainment, of, you know, going from a complete loser nerd to a which I always resent anyway, to, you know, the cool guy. And in this one's sort of like a morality tale for nerds, really, because it's just like, see what happens to you when you become cool and start running with the cool crowd. He would have been fine if he would have held on to those nerd glasses and the greasy hair, but.
Well, you know, he'd have been fine if he hadn't started dating Lee. You know, I think he and Christine could have been happy for a while, but.
Yes. Yeah,
but when you talk about a boy in his car, I mean, look at the live action Transformers movie.
Yep.
It's the same basic story, isn't it? A boy in his car, and it's like you said, he's got a loser who gets the car, and suddenly he's calm and cool, and he gets the girl, and he's, you know, he's not a screw-up, and he's not just a loser living in his parents' house.
Yep.
It's like, yeah, except that in Transformers, you know, it works out pretty good for him. And Christine, again, not so much.
Well, I was just going to say, what would happen if King and Carpenter got their hands on the next Transformers movie? Now, that could be something I would go to see in the theater.
I think it wouldn't suck.
No, not at all. It couldn't. It just couldn't.
That would certainly be interesting.
Well, I noticed this movie, and this is why I didn't not like it when I was when I first saw it. But I saw the movie right off of reading the book, and I was always like a stickler for, you know, things being the same or sticking closely to it. And and it's funny, I've seen a lot of John Carpenter interviews. I've been watching a lot of interviews lately, And I saw one where he's talking about Christine, and they asked him, why did you choose Christine as your next project? And he said, well, I needed a job. I needed to do a movie because I wanted to get some money, and someone said you should do Christine. I said, okay, I like Stephen King. So, and I think he approached it maybe more as a commercial project venture. So there's maybe a little less John Carpenter in this and more of just, you know, I want to turn in a good adaptation of Stephen King. One thing he dumped was in the Stephen King book, the car's old owner would be in the back seat talking to Arnie. Was it Arnie or Artie?
Arnie.
Keep wanting to call him Artie. But,
Roland LeBay ultimately was the force possessing Christine. Mm-hmm. The first scene in the film, and with Christine on the assembly line, is not in the book, because the idea in the film is that she was, you know, born bad, that she's always had this malevolent female personality. I actually like the film version of Christine more than I like the novel, which is saying something, because Christine is my favorite one of King's novels. I like the idea that Christine is a female. The ending of the novel of Christine falls down for me because
it's a little less creepy.
Yeah, because it's Roland, and it's like it's a dude.
Yeah, like, yeah, and not even to tweak, like, you know, like the homosexual aspect of it, but he's an old creepy dude too on top of it. So it's just, you know, yeah, all kinds of wrong.
And I tell you, I really love the first scene on the assembly line, because, you know, Christine's rolling down the assembly line, and the way that Carpenter shoots it, it's like that kind of stereotypical, you know, the babe walking shot from any movie?
Yeah,
you'll see the shot in front, and you'll see her chest, and you won't see her head. Well, what's the first shot we get? It's of her headlights and grill rolling down. And then you'll see the shot over the back shoulder where you see her hair, and then we get the shot over her rear fender. And then you get the full shot where she's doing the whole strut, and we get the full shot of her walking. It's like, of course, because she's the, you know, she's the female lead of the movie, not Lee. You know, Christine's the she's the main feminine energy in this movie. Of course she gets the babe shot. She's the babe.
Oh yeah, it's like the vampire, you know. You have the lead guy in a movie who ends up killing the vampire, but the vampire's always like better looking, more interesting, smarter, suaver, stronger, you know, and that's what Christine is. She's there's nothing that once Arnie meets Christine, there's, you know, nothing he's not gonna, you know, give up for her if it comes to that. Classic femme fatale, you know.
Yeah, very much. Yeah, it's a really good point. And I like the symmetry, because the first day of school, you know, Dennis sees Lee, and if you've read the book, you know that Dennis and Lee get together, and you know that Dennis, he's in love with Lee from the first time he sees her. Well, then what happens after the scene with Buddy and Moochie and all them? They're rolling back home, and then Arnie sees Christine, and it's the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He is in love with her from the moment that he sees her when she's all beat up in LeBay's front yard. You know, it's like, I like that symmetry of the idea of love at first sight. You know, again, another very typical sort of Americana 50s motif.
Yeah, you're right. I didn't notice that. Excellent. And you know what? Another thing that I love about this movie, Harry Dean Stanton.
Yeah.
One of my he's just one of my favorite actors ever. I've just never seen him do wrong, you know. And I'd forgotten that he was, you know, in this movie, you know, and playing, of course, a perfect Harry Dean Stanton role, a detective.
Yeah.
And, you know, the second he walked on the screen, I was in my room and I literally, you know, pumped my hands up in the air. I was just like, oh, yes, that's right. Harry Dean Stanton. He's not in it much, but every scene is great, you know.
Well, another thing I made a note of is that we talked about during the previous episode, which was In the Mouth of Madness, that the score was not really very, very Carpenter-esque. It wasn't really that sort of typical Carpenter score. This one, on the other hand, is a complete 180. This is a very typical Carpenter score. When Christine is hunting down Moochie through the streets,
yeah,
it's boom. And, you know, feel free to plug in the actual song in case my acapella rendition, you know, doesn't do it for you. But, you know, when Christine's chasing him down, it's got that driving, pumping song, and you're like, it really, it sets it so much, because, you know, really, if you think about it, getting crushed to death by 2 tons of Detroit steel has got to be one of the most unnatural yet commonplace ways to die, especially in the United States.
Yes, you're right.
But you think about that, it's so unnatural. The automobile itself is so far removed from anything that nature has ever produced, and to be crushed to death by it, to be crushed in half and have your legs taken out on a shovel, that's just so beyond anything that the human body was ever designed to endure. And then, you know, Moochie's a scumbag, but you feel bad for him getting, he thinks he's safe in the little alley, and she crushes herself to kill him. It's like, oh my damn.
It does beg the question of why Moochie just didn't sort of jump up onto the hood and run over the car. That's what I would have done.
Yeah.
But
no, he's the fat.
That scene in the movie was so, that was like the icon, that was the scene when the movie came out that they gave to all the movie critics to show on TV.
Yeah.
Where because it was so tense, you know, the way that Christine's just forcing herself down the alley, and you know, because the idea of a car had been, a killer car had been done before with not as much success. The whole idea of it's pretty goofy, you know, to if you really think about it too much. But you know, but when you had that sheer visceral, you know, when you see, and John Carpenter knew how to film a car, you know, it reminded me of, like, the only other guy I think who really, like, films cars as lovingly is George Miller of you know, Mad Max movies. You really got the feel for the power of Christine's engine. And the only car I ever owned was a Plymouth Fury. And I know a Plymouth Fury, I had a 1971 Plymouth Fury. It was like a boat, you know. It was like sailing, when you'd go up a hill, you know, the bow of it would raise up and stuff. And, you know, the doors on those things could cut a person in half if you opened them up, you know. That it was just like the heaviest, you know, huge gas guzzling engine. And and he really, and when Christine gets smashed up and is bending back out, I mean, especially in the pre-CG days, it really, you can feel that metal crunching and popping back out. And
yeah,
it's
that's,
very.
That's
I
one
mean,
of the things that strikes me immediately is all the scenes where she reassembles herself are spec fucking tacular.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
it's the oldest trick in the book, but it looks great.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we talked about with Prince of Darkness. It's, you know, simple but effective. You know, it's again in the context. You know, we're informed, intelligent filmgoers and film critics. We know that how it was shot, that it was impacted and then shown the film reversed to look like she was repairing herself. But when you're watching it, it's put together in such a way that you totally believe that she's rebuilding herself.
Your
brain knows she's doing it.
He makes that car look physically angry. It's like an angry bull, you know. It's almost like the car's muscles are twitching and tensing up. It's intense.
Yeah.
And you know, and the revving of the engine, you know, the revving of an engine is such an expressive thing anyway, you know. It's one of the closest things, man-made things, that has come to being, you know, like a wild animal. And then when you have, you know, what I really love about when Christine attacks, I love how this car would literally bite on to other cars.
Yeah.
You know, she'd hit him with the front end and it would stick as if she had her teeth, you know, she'd grab right on and tear him up, you know, like a dog, you know?
Yeah, I mean, when she takes out Buddy and I forget the other two punks at the, you know, she chases them down and then at the gas station. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, she just plows into Buddy's, I'm not sure what he's driving. I think he's driving like a GTO or something, wasn't he? And then she just tears it up and pulls it out and then just throws it back out at him. I'm like, oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
I can't imagine that.
No, it's funny.
I feel kind of bad for the dude who's working in the gas station, because, yeah, I know he was there and attacked Christine, but seriously, he's just working. He doesn't know what the hell's going on.
Yeah, who wouldn't attack Christine at that point, you know? Yeah, he was just a poor innocent bystander at that point. Well, that it's funny because that Christine's kills at the gas station there are the only ones that I count as, like, when she chases down Buddy Ruperton. And this is another thing I saw in other people have noticed this, and I remember actually critics noticing this in the day, is, you know, why does he just run down the middle of the road when she's chasing him? If you're being chased by a car, you know, it's probably better to go off-road, you know, at that point. But he just runs down the middle of the road till she runs him down. But,
you know, Ruperton's not the brightest bulb in the drawer either.
Right. Well, they had I saw an interview where they had some horror convention. They had reconvened a good chunk of the cast of Christine and John Carpenter, and the actor who played Buddy Ruperton, who is funny, who he looks sort of like John Travolta, in that movie, and he looks like the older version of John Travolta now. You know, he asked John Carpenter. He said, "Why am I running down the middle of the road, you know, away from this car?" And John Carpenter said, "Well, that's easy because it's a movie."
Yeah.
And he said, "Oh, okay."
that's something you could really see John Carpenter saying too. Like, Dragon's Secret. That's easy.
Yeah, exactly. It was beautiful because there was one of the interviews I watched was John Carpenter basically talking about Halloween, and they were showing whole sequences with him talking over it, and one of the things he kept saying over and over again is, "Okay, you're going to see a little smoke from my cigarette here," and sure enough, there's Jamie Lee Curtis talking to her friends, and you see a little of John Carpenter's cigarette smoke flopping across the screen, and it's amazing how many times that happens in his movies. He's just like, "I just leave it in."
Talk about Christine chasing down Buddy Ruperton. One of my favorite images in this movie is Christine on fire, because you think about the Plymouth Fury. The reason why King said he chose the Plymouth Fury was that it was the right size car that had a big V8 engine that didn't have any mythology about it at all. It was a pretty anonymous car, unless you happen to have owned one or whatnot. It's not like, you know, a Corvette or a Corvair or the Mustang or the Galaxy or something like that, where it had some sort of culture.
Iconic status.
Exactly. The main thing that the Fury was known for, besides being the Plymouth Showcase, is it was something that was used as a basis for making hot rods. So Christine on fire, she's kind of the ultimate hot rod with her flame job, except that now it's not vinyl, you know. She's the ultimate hot rod coming to run down this greaser punk.
Yeah. I may have to watch it again.
I mean, you know, it's true. I mean, really, at the end of the day, this is an adaption. But, you know, there's little things like that, you know, if this had been, you know, just Joe Bloggs that the studio got, that we might not have gotten little things like that, like Christine on fire. I don't think that's in the book. You know, that's something that I think came up with from a visual standpoint. It's cool to see her on fire like that.
Well, I remember, you know, I have a sort of, I have a, when this, when the book came out, we had a substitute teacher, and he was one of those cool substitute teachers. You know, he was probably like 30 years old or maybe even a little younger. He was extremely overweight, and he looked like Orson Welles, you know, a bit, and his name was Danny Doan. And he was always a substitute for English class or social studies, and he was just always seemed he was a cool I say he's a was a cool substitute because he was kind of nerdy, and one day in a study hall I noticed he was reading Christine, and I thought that, you know, that was a really big deal to me to see a teacher reading a Stephen King book in class. For some reason, I thought that's really cool. So I went over and talked to him, and he said, "Well, yeah, I'm friends with John Carpenter. I'm pen pals with him. And this is the next movie he's going to do. And he was asking me if I would help him with, because he's going to write the script." And I was like, "Wah, wah, wah, wah," you know, and all of a sudden I wanted to be this guy's, you know, best friend. And so I immediately went out and read Christine and was all, you know, wound up for it, and The guy ended up dying of a heart attack within like 3 or 4 months of that. Just like instantaneously, you know, he was morbidly obese. He was maybe 2 Orson Welles. You know what I mean?
That's
pretty big. Careful now. One of the hosts of the show might be in that same range.
2 Orson Welles?
Getting there.
Let's just say that there was always great irony to me that the last film Orson Welles was in before he died, he actually played his own planet. So
yes.
Really? What movie was that?
Transformers.
That would be Transformers movie. He played Unicron, the evil dark god of the Transformers who transforms into a giant planet.
Oh, it was one of the animated Transformers movies.
It was the first first Transformers.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, because I was going to say, he didn't make it to that. What did they, like, can his voice, like, years earlier or something?
He died pretty much right after.
He didn't make it through the production of Transformers the movie in 1986. He died during post-production, and there's a long-standing rumor that Leonard Nimoy, voice of Galvatron, looped one of Welles' lines. It's actually the last line Unicron has. If you listen to it, it sounds like Leonard Nimoy, but Nimoy denies it. But, you know, who knows? Nimoy wouldn't talk about Transformers for about 20 years after it was made. So, I don't remember starring in such a film, you know, that kind of thing.
There might be some Screen Actors Guild technicality that he's trying to avoid with that.
Well, he'll talk about it now. I think now that he realized that, wait a minute, trans fans like spending money just like Trekkies, suddenly he's cool with it, but, you know, I don't know. Anyway.
I haven't told you guys yet, but I have been... We cross our fingers, but I have sent an email off to John Carpenter's publicist, telling them who we are and what we're doing.
Uh-oh.
And I played the Carthage, New York card as hard as I could. So that's my next goal, is to get him on here to answer for some of these movies. And I'm dying to ask him about Danny Doan. I'm dying to ask him if he actually knew this guy or if this teacher was just like blowing smoke up my ass, which I strongly suspect. But at the same time,
why would you make that up?
Well, because in my hometown, weren't many people that like you could actually say were ever came out of there who were quote unquote famous, and so, you know, I think he left town before he was 5 years old, you know, so I don't imagine him having any memories of Carthage beyond any kind of, you know, those weird fuzzy childhood, you know, memories of, Carthage, I mean, everybody in Carthage, from little old ladies to, you know, little kids, knew who John Carpenter was. When he married Adrienne Barbeau, we went berserk. We were so happy. Oh, all us teenage boys were just like, really? There's hope for us Carthage boys. Because we'd all watch
the overflow on that one.
Yeah, we'd all seen Escape from New York, and trust Swamp me, Thing. We'd all watched Swamp Thing every time that came on TV, just for the scene of her taking a little skinny dip in the swamp. Especially me.
Yeah.
That's about the only reason to watch that movie now.
Oh, you're lucky Scott Gardner is it here. We might have to have a dispute about that, but that's for another show, another time. Swamp Thing 2, now, there's pretty much unanimous agreement.
Hey, I love the Leech Man from Swamp Thing 2. That is an awesomely silly monster.
Swamp Thing 1's a Tobe Hooper movie, you know?
I mean, yeah, Tobe Hooper.
You gotta give it some...
And according to Tobe Hooper, that is, I think, the movie he's made the most money on just from royalties from it playing on TV all the time.
That's funny. That's funny how that stuff works out. And another rumor, I know I've emailed both of you, but we might as well say it, as I've heard, well, it's not a rumor, John Carpenter does have another movie out. It's called The Ward.
Yes, it was making the art house circuit last I heard.
Mm-hmm.
Not the art house, like the film festival circuit, I should say.
Yeah, I saw a lot of, you know, like red carpet interviews from all the actors and actresses are really young. They're all in their 20s, it looks like, pretty much. It was at the Toronto Film Fest, I think. I didn't see a single scene from the movie. I couldn't find a single trailer or anything. It seems to concern like a girl who gets put into a mental institution, it seems, wrongly. Maybe she's buffaloed in there somehow, and it's a ghost story. It's a haunted, you know, there's something funny going on at the mental institution, but there's also a haunting that she has to figure out. And from his interviews, he said he's doing a very, you know, trying to do a very traditional ghost story, not a big special effects movie, something that relies more on atmosphere. So instantly, that sounds good to me. I found one review of it, and it was by a just obviously very uptight lady who likes her art films.
Yeah.
prefaces her whole review going, "Well, I don't watch horror movies, and I don't really know much about the genre."
Then shut the fuck up.
And then she starts by blowing smoke up Carpenter's ass and talking about how she's done her research, and apparently he's done some really influential movies and real good movies, and then she just trashes it. That being said, this movie has, and I'm thinking, well, if it's a classic horror movie, then I'm imagining every nuance and every reference and every, you know, everything just went flying over her head. So it could be a subpar John Carpenter movie, but I'm not going to go on that review to, you know, her completely dogging it review as being anywhere near reality, you know, especially judging by, you know, past experience with reviews in John Carpenter movies.
Oh yeah, but we've talked about it on this very podcast that you know, The Thing got savaged by the critics. Prince of Darkness was just chewed up, bad out, in the mouth of madness. If they even bothered to talk about it, it was just to badmouth it. It's like, you know, Carpenter's a great filmmaker. You know, anyone who's watched his movies will tell you that. But he just seems to, I think a lot of it, he rubs critics the wrong way because he doesn't care. He doesn't seem to care about critic approval.
No, he doesn't. Well, he definitely doesn't seek it. The only time I think, and I don't know if he was seeking it, or the only movie he had that was like made for critical approval, I think, was Starman, and it got it. You know, I mean, Starman, you know, but I think, you know, Starman, by having that sort of melodrama romance angle to it, and Jeff Bridges, who's a great actor, who now is acknowledged, you know, he's won Best Actor. But at that time, you know, I consider Kurt Russell just as good an actor as him, as Jeff Bridges. But at that point, you know, that movie was definitely something that the critics could glom onto. But I doubt that Carpenter was like, you know, I really need some love from the critics right now. I need to do something very accessible.
But you know, it's been my experience that all of the horror directors that are considered influential, or, you know, have really given great things to the horror genre on film, I don't think any of them really care about whether the critics like their crap or not. You know, I don't think Dario Argento ever worried about whether or not a critic liked one of his movies. You know, I remember if you watch the Anchor Bay 2-disc special edition of Opera, which was one of Argento's kind of 90s films, he talks about that after he made Opera, he went into a deep depression because he thought he had not made a good film personally. That he didn't care what anyone else thought. He didn't care if the movie made money or didn't. Didn't care if it got good reviews or not. He felt he had not made the best film he could. And I think ultimately that any director that's worth his or her salt, that's what they care about. Making the film that they produce something that was good, however you want to define that, however they want to define it. If they define it as being good, if it's got to make $300 million, well, then you're more than likely going to be disappointed because most films don't make $300 million. If your definition of good is that, you know, almost 30 years after the movie was made, there's enough fans about it that we're doing a podcast that people are going to download and listen to as we talk about it, well, then, you know, then there's a good chance if you're a good filmmaker that you might get that kind of success. You know, ultimately, you know, filmmaking is like anything else. It's a commercial endeavor, but you know, it's got to be about the people doing it. And it's got to be about doing something that you find is not only that you enjoy, but that you've created something that you're proud of.
Well, it's funny because, I mean, I think Stephen King and John Carpenter both find them, and it's really funny that this is their only collaboration, because I find that they're very similar in their careers, where they're both very successful at what they do. And, you know, John Carpenter as a filmmaker to me stands up to any other filmmaker as far as his directorial style and his editing. And, you know, he's an auteur. He does, you know, he'll often write it, you know, direct it and make the music for it. And he's, I imagine he's probably in the editing room just about all the way through these, you know, the making of these movies too. And he's associated with the horror genre like Stephen King. And both of those are commercially viable. Like, the horror genre is known for being commercially viable. You know, people love to be scared. Yeah. But it's also known for being, you know, just hardly ever acknowledged artistically. And when it is, it's often, you know, just very condescendingly like, oh, well, you know, I mean, this is really good for a horror novel. It was sort of like last month's...
Yeah.
Installment where the protagonist was reading the horror books going, hey, you know, these are pretty good, you know? I thought they would just be a stupid horror book, but they're actually pretty good. And you could almost look at that last one as almost a collaboration with Stephen King, because it's got a bit of that
yeah, flavor
to it.
It was more of an homage.
Tribute, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, both of them are, you know, valid artists, and as time goes on, you know, their classics are being considered as true classics and not just by fans of the genre. You know, the people I know that read Stephen King, you know, talk about The Stand as if it was, you know, a Charles Dickens novel. And,
yeah.
You know, really, in a it is. I mean, when Charles Dickens was writing his novels, he was a popular writer. He was a pop writer of the time, you know, a best-selling author who was writing, you know, exciting stories for people to read. And only now is it, and, you know, there'll be a day when these John Carpenter movies and the Stephen King movies are starting to, but where they'll actually be dissected and, you know, John Carpenter might be held in, you know, the same regard as, say, Hitchcock, who is one of the exceptions of who could do horrifying stuff but still maintain his status as a great director. And I think it's because his horror stuff was all sort of based in reality, except for maybe the birds. But...
Go ahead,
Hero. It was going to be a big tangent, so... Leave it.
No, tangent away, man.
I was just in terms of speaking about Carpenter as an auteur. Do you think that the only way that he's been allowed to remain an auteur is because his films technically don't make a lot of money, and he's never really propelled himself after Halloween into the stratosphere of directors? I mean, you'd have to imagine the pressure associated with being a big time, big budget director that his freedom would be absolutely just cut off at the knees. I mean, is it almost a blessing that he's enjoyed sort of cult status, especially in this country?
I would say yes.
Yeah.
I'm a firm believer in the cult status and the limited budget actually ending up being in the long run of freedom. And I'm also, I was just thinking about this today, the mass audience versus a smaller audience. And a lot of times, like, I think if you have a message or you have something or that you want to communicate that's more you know specific to you, it's almost better to aim it at a smaller audience, because in order to aim something, in order to get that mass audience, you know, your message probably isn't going to, unless it just happens to be that right thing at the right time, it's not going to be the thing that the mass of people want to see or hear or pay attention to. But if you tailor it for those people who are going to get it or are going to understand it and like it, they'll hold on to it and they'll keep it around. You know, They Live is a great example of that, which was, I mean, that was not a big movie by any means, but the people who saw it and liked it, and they were mostly people like me who were like, ooh, there's a new John Carpenter. I can't tell you how many times I've gotten someone to go to a John Carpenter movie with me, because we've been at a theater and I've looked up and I've said, oh, there's a John Carpenter movie playing here. Well, we gotta go see this. This is gonna be good. I did that with Big Trouble in Little China, with In the Mouth of Madness, and with They Live. We're all like, just walk up to a movie theater and it's like, oh, when did this happen? And
hey, when it was In the Mouth of Madness, was it like a big lit up marquee with the flashing lights and everything?
It was, actually. It was
in a big bowl of popcorn and sit right in front and all that.
It was in a very classic movie theater. It was. And the scary thing was, is maybe there were like 10 people in that movie theater that night. So it was kind of creepy like that. And but I mean, with They Live, I went and saw that like 3 days later. I went and saw it again, and for years I'd been like renting it on video and making my friends see it, and now it's being remade, you know. Now, you know,
I mean, you know, you're absolutely right. If you're people. if there is no expectation of your movie to make any money, you can make whatever you want. You know, let me give an analogy. Obviously, a lot of our listeners, I'm sure, read comics. You know, they're two true freaks listeners after all. You know, one of the knocks on Charlton back in the day was that, well, they didn't pay very well, but they let you do whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so there was always good stuff coming out of Charlton, especially in, you know, some of their, especially their lower tier titles. Like, I like war comics. So, like, fighting Army, fighting Navy, fighting Marines, things like that. There was progressive sort of stories in a lot of these because the creators were kind of given free rein. Because the editors knew, like, well, you know, we're not paying you all that much, but we're not expecting a whole lot, so you guys, you know, do what you want.
Yeah,
you know, have
they
fun
were
with
basically
it.
Expecting them to fill up a comic book in time to print it and get it out
right.
there for the certain
print
number of
people. Print it on their cereal box printing press.
Yes, yes. You
know? And it's the same idea. If Joe Q Studio, you know, agrees to, okay, we'll give you some money to make a movie, but we're not expecting much out of it. You know, maybe we'll make some money on DVD release or whatever. You know, they're not going to be pouring over your rushes every day, making sure that you're hitting the female 18 to 35 demographic. They don't care. You know, they got bigger irons in the fire they got to worry about than you know, the little guy shooting it on his digital 8 or whatever. You know, so yeah, it offers you that freedom, and if you're someone who has the skills to make something out of that, a la John Carpenter, then, you know, you can turn that into an entire career of making films for your audience, because your audience knows what to expect, and you know that they're willing to work with you. You tell somebody on the, tell Joe Bloggs on the street the plot of In the Mouth of Madness, they're not gonna dig that. They're like, what, okay, old gods, what is that? I don't know what that means. But, you know, somebody who's obviously, willing to work with it, they get rewarded for it.
But guess
Christine
what?
Is,
now
again,
that,
a little more commercial, but, you know.
There's been a 3-part South Park with Cthulhu in it, you know. Now a rerun of In the Mouth of Madness on TV. There might be a few more people who are like, hey, wait a minute, that's Cthulhu, you know. So, look at John Carpenter. A lot of people don't think about it, but I mean, John Carpenter sprung from the same well at the same general time as, you know, Coppola. You know, he was right, but like Coppola was the first one out, and then you had your Lucas and Spielberg, you know, sort of coming out behind that USC.
Yeah,
group
I was gonna
of,
say the USC and UCLA crew.
Right, and they were all, and I mean, you know, John Carpenter very much, you know, had a very similar beginning to George Lucas, where he did a science fiction short that got you know, money to make it into a full-length movie, which they had to do completely, you know, low budget, you know, sort of Corman style. And I think, obviously, you know, Carpenter probably was a really big fan of those sort of Carpenter drive-in sort of movie, low-budget horror movies, too, that it's just a natural... I think when you start out doing that low budget, get it done, get it on budget or under budget, you know, and you're not a hack. You know, you have hacks who do it, and then you have like real filmmakers who do it, and a lot of real filmmakers are looking to go into the bigger budgets and bigger stratospheres. But when you get the guys like Carpenter who say, you know, sort of, well, you know, maybe I don't want to go there, but every once in a while they're going to have a successful movie that will give them enough money and credibility to, at least when they want to make a movie, step up and say, "Hey, I want to do a movie," and propose a really, you know, meager budget relative to anything else. You're almost guaranteed to make your movie. You know, that's how George Romero, after he did Land of the Dead, he said he'll never do a big production ever again. He'll never work with the big boys ever again. So,
you know, you and drive-in. Does anybody know what movie is it that they go to see at the drive-in? That Arnie and Lee go to see at the drive-in. I couldn't identify it just looking at it.
Oh, I couldn't tell either.
I was, when they went to the drive-in, I'm like, watch this be one of John Carpenter's movies. I'd have laughed if it was like Dark Star that they went to go see or something, but,
right,
you know.
Right, or
Halloween.
Precinct 13 would have been perfect,
yeah.
You know.
Precinct 13 would have been great, or you know, Halloween, which would have been then a side joke to Halloween 3 anyway. But,
yeah.
I'm trying to figure it out, I didn't do my research. I don't know what it is, but... you know, that the drive-in scene to me is really kind of underrated, because we think about Christine's kills in this movie, running down Moochie, you know, tearing up Buddy and his crew, and then the whole bit at Darnell's and all that. Whereas when she tries to kill Lee, it's very artfully shot. It's very, I know I've talked about this before, that Dario Argento has been described as shooting love scenes like murders and murders like love scenes. And I think that's the scene at the drive-in. It's kind
you
of...
You guys want
kind
the answer for that?
Yeah.
I just found the answer for that. It's a movie called Thank God It's Friday.
Thank God it's...
With Donna Summer and Jeff Goldblum.
Yes, I remember when that movie came out.
Thank God. I don't know that one. I had to look that one up.
There's a million comics from the 70s that I can see that it had one of those really busy posters that was drawn by a Mad Magazine artist with, you know, the whole cast. It was one of those huge ensemble casts, so it's like this disco with this black guy with a huge afro and cap, you know, DJing, and the whole cast laid out behind him in Mad Magazine, like Mort
Thank
Drucker.
God. Oh, here. I just looked it up in Leonard Maltin's movie guide. Thank God It's Friday, 1978. Bomb, which means less than one.
Hey, it's got an Academy Award.
Donna
Best
Summer, Valerie Lansford, Jeff Goldblum, Deborah Winger, The Commodores, with Lionel Richie. Is this perhaps the worst film ever to have won some kind of Oscar? for Donna Summer's song, It's on Last Dance.
Wow. Yeah, which is a great song, but, you know, yeah, it had to be something like that, you know. It's sort of like movies
winning.
Life of
a Disco Comedy is about as monotonous and uninventive as disco music itself. Out!
It came out right. There was another one. It was like came out the same time as the Village People, Can't Stop the Music movie. That was very similar. They probably ripped each other off.
Wow. You know, it's funny. In the novel, they go to see Grease, actually.
That would have been perfect.
Yeah, and what's funny is that it's actually Dennis and Lee go to see Grease, and every time that Dennis, like Lee said that she want, like there's like a whole conversation about wanting to see Grease because all of her girlfriends have seen it, and they've all told her, oh, the ending is the best part. And then anytime Dennis tells anyone he's going to see Grease, they say, oh yeah, the ending's the best part. And then he's getting the popcorn at the theater, and the guy goes, oh, what movie you see? And he goes, Grease. He goes, oh, yeah. He goes, yeah, I know. The ending's the best part. I got it.
And of course, it's the people descending to heaven in their car.
Yeah. Appropriate, again, considering Christine, how many people are sent to heaven by Christine.
That's true.
And
yeah,
you know,
I forgot that. Grease is what sort of brought back that's right, in the 70s there was that 50s revival.
Oh yeah.
You had Grease, you had Sha Na Na had their own TV show.
Well,
so,
just watch, you know, my favorite film of all time, which is Phantom of the Paradise, which is directed by Brian De Palma.
I've never seen it. I've wanted to see that for a long time.
Oh, I absolutely love this movie.
It's with Artie Johnson, right?
No.
Is the Phantom?
It's Paul Williams.
Paul Williams. I always get those two mixed up.
I, you know, Paul Williams and William Finley and Jessica Harper and Derek Graham are in Phantom of the Paradise. But they talk about in that film that, you know, I forget exactly the words, but they talk about at the very beginning about how Swan, who is the Paul Williams character, he's a music producer. How he was the one that caused the 70s to love the 50s and brought back, you know, Grease Rock and all that stuff. And now he wants the new sound. You know, every decade's in love with another one, you know.
Uh-huh.
Except for the 90s, which was in love with itself. But, you know, that's again a topic for another episode.
I like that. That is true. But, yeah, the 90s were should have been worshipping the 70s or 80s. I don't know what
they did to a degree worship the 70s. I mean, just like now, you look at the last decade.
Ironically, though.
Yeah, it was kind of in that sort of too cool for school hipster sort of way. Whereas now we look at...
90s, you couldn't tell if they really liked anything.
Yeah. It's like, you know, that the Simpsons episode where they're at Hubba Palooza. It's like, oh yeah, this is really cool. Are you being sarcastic? I don't even know anymore.
I don't even know, yeah.
Whereas now, if you look at the way the last decade has looked at the 80s with such loving reverence, it's like, yeah, because all of us that were kids in the 80s now have disposable income. That's all that means.
Yes.
That was when I decided that was when the Simpsons were the hippest show on TV, because when they did that Hullabalooza and they showed the scene of everybody just sort of standing there with their arms crossed, doing the sort of sway back and forth, sort of just going, that's when I had been to concerts like that, and I was just like, this is beautiful. You don't see this captured on satirized as much as it should be.
And what's the line? Like, wow, you guys are really doing a great job. Making teenagers depressed, that's like shooting fish in a barrel.
Oh, but so what do you think? What I know, Luke, that you had an idea of what we should do next on our agenda.
Yeah. Well, you know, we kind of threw out Christine last time, kind of on the fly, and after we did that, I was taking a look at just you know, the films that Carpenter made around Christine, around that early '80s period, and so. I'm saying next time we should talk about The Fog.
Carpenter's, I'm really into that because I have not seen
story.
The Fog yet.
Well, The Fog is a tremendous little movie, I tell you. You know, don't let the fact that it was made into a god-awful, terrible remake several years ago put you off if you folks haven't seen, if you're like Chris and haven't seen The Fog, because it is a very effective little ghost story that doesn't rely on, you know, spooky, sort of goofy CG effects like they feel that we want from a ghost story nowadays. It relies a lot on mood and lighting and Adrien Barbeau, so...
Adrien Barbeau? Okay, I'm in.
Oh, okay, dude. Adrien Barbeau. I agree with Luke on that one. It, It's a quite effective little Victorian-style horror film.
Well, in one of his interviews, he said he wanted to make it for kids. He said he wanted it to be a kids-style ghost story, you know, just a simple, scary ghost story that wasn't so bloody that you couldn't take... didn't it end up with a PG rating?
Well, I'm pretty sure it's rated R.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Rated R. Yeah.
They made him cut in some more violence, or that yeah. The studio strongly suggests he added more violence to it. And that's right. He wanted to make it PG so that it would be something that like parents could take their kids to traumatize their kids legally. It doesn't matter. Back, you know, I don't think the R rating stops a lot of parents either
no.
way. And I think the parents...
You know, when I was right around my 7th birthday, I may have told this story on the show before, and if I have, I'm sorry for repeating myself. But right at my right around my 7th birthday, which was, wait for it, 1987, we went to... My father took my brother, who's 2 years older than me, my mother, and myself to the movie theaters for a double feature of Predator, followed by the sneak preview of RoboCop.
Yeah.
So that, you know,
RoboCop was a pretty hard, was pretty meaty as far as, it still is pretty intense.
I mean, I can trace a lot of my interest to that night. You know, my
yeah.
interest now as a grown-up, I say that with air quotes, I'll hold it up to the mic so you guys can see. But, you know, that's, you know, it all goes back to that night. So again, was my mom mad? Yeah. Do I care? No. So.
What about you, Hero? Did you ever have I had, when I was about that age, it was Night of the Living Dead that I saw that was just like, holy
cow.
I
know. I'll give you the two experiences.
Yes, that's why we're all here today. It's funny. I knew you had to have, and you have double the experiences, so man, you must be fucked up.
Totally. Oh, Jesus, I just sounded like Andy Brackett from Halloween there.
Totally.
The first one. Probably a little too. I'm only a year older than Luke, but I remember my father saying, "This is a great adventure story. I want to show you. It's called Raiders of the Lost Ark," and I'm right in there with it until they start going through that goddamn cave, and Forrestal comes flying out on that rack of spikes. I said, "I'm not watching this right now. It's not happening." It scared the shit out of me. And that's one of my favorite films of all time. But yeah, I mean, that's how it goes. And the other thing was. My father sat down and said, this is a great science fiction story I want to show you. It's called Alien.
Yeah.
And I was still a little young at the time. And, when that bad boy comes flying out of his chest, see you later, forget about
oh,
it.
Yeah.
That was it. After that, I mean, there was no stopping me after that. You know, then you'd sneak around and you'd see Predator on HBO, and when Carl Weathers' hand gets chopped off and his gun's still shooting, I'm like, this is the shit right here. This is the stuff that I want to watch for the rest of my life. Oh, man.
That was what I was thinking last week when I was watching the new Walking Dead, and you see the redneck character just puts a pickaxe into this, you know, corpse that's on the ground, and it had to be the most realistic pickaxe to a head I've ever seen. I was just like, yes! Now, this is TV. That looked like a real pickaxe to the head. My God, the way the bone splintered? Awesome.
Does anybody else find it funny that AMC will show that at 10 o'clock at night, and they won't edit anything, but if you try to watch like an R-rated 80s action movie on it, they chop everything out?
They know where they're making their money. They're making their money by buying my sell series, so...
Well, yeah, I'm gonna say, and now that this show's such a success, they may start pushing it, you know, even further. So I'm very excited about that. But it's funny, I had my mother was the one. She took me to the movie theater to see Raiders, and I remember being shocked at that age at how violent that movie was. And my dad took me to Alien too, and that one, and yeah, the chestburster scene, in that one was. It was it was me and a bunch of my friends, and it's funny when that came out on HBO. My friend George actually took his tape recorder and just taped the part where the alien burst out of the chest, and he brought it into school, and we would listen to it over and over and crack up, and it was probably our way of cathartically dealing with the terror of that scene, because that scene was just, yeah, over the top, scary and gross for the day. And it's good to hear that even though movies get more intense as time goes on, that it doesn't matter if you're still young and you see Raiders of the Lost Ark, you're just like, holy shit, that's violent.
Yeah. Well, that was, what, 81? 80, 81? So I was 2, maybe 3 when that came out, and I think he sat me down to watch it when I was about 5 or 6. Still a little young. Now, a little side note here, I have a 6-year-old nephew, and his dad just showed him Predator. Oh my God, he was running around the whole next day going, I'm here, come on, kill me now, do it.
I gotta admit, we used to yell, yeah, kill me, come on.
My friends dragged me to the movies to see that movie, and I was just like, I don't want to see this Schwarzenegger movie. And, you know, within the first 10 minutes, I was like, all right, this is okay. You know, this is just your standard, you know, blow everything up. But I like Carl Weathers, and Schwarzenegger was doing really good. And then I was just like, really, you know, that was like Jesse Ventura's, you know, I was just like, whoa, this Jesse Ventura is awesome. And then once you started putting the Predator aspect in it, I was totally sold. I was just like, wow.
That's why that one works so well, because it just hit you.
But, you know, if you make we're getting back to talking about if you're not a hack, if you make good movies, you know, you can push the envelope all you want on violence and effects and everything else. If you make something and you make a shot or make a film or make whatever, make it with quality and make it with care, it'll hold up. You know, there's a great example of that in Christine. At the end, when they're in Darnell's garage, okay, you know, they got the whole scene of Dennis and Lee getting ready with the bulldozer, and he says, oh, you better go lock yourself in the office, and as soon as you hear that door open, you know, you close the, or you hear the, me start this up, you close that door, and then she's walking, and then the boom, lights come on, you know, and you hear Christine come to life, and it's like, oh, shit, you know, that, I mean, I knew it was coming, and it still startled me.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And it's like, because it's like, okay, it's crafted so well. It's like, oh, you know, I remember the first time that I watched this with my wife, she jumped out of the seat. And it's like, again, it's getting back to when Carpenter was talking about watching a thing from another world, and he said the popcorn kept flying up, you know?
Yeah.
If you make a scene where the popcorn's going to fly up and you do it well, it's always going to do it.
It's no coincidence that John Carpenter also writes, is a musician too, you know, and there's that music in his movies, you know, there's always a rhythm and a tone and a, you know, and yeah, Christine is, that is, you know, the timing of when those lights come on is so important, you know, and it's so easy also to throw something at somebody and get a cheap jump. But when you do that timed perfectly moment like that, where it's not just a startle because the lights come on, but there's a bit of the startle in there, but at the same time it plays the element of dread, you know.
Oh yeah, because
you come to the realization of, oh God, the car's already in here.
Yeah, and they've
ready to roll
time,
and
yeah, they spent all this time coming up with this plan and now they're fucked.
Yeah.
You know, not to put too fine a point on it. It's and actually, you know, another scene that you talk about having a rhythm and a flow, and I was talking earlier about the assembly line scene being kind of a riff on the classic Babe strut shot. When the hoods are in Darnell's and they surround Christine and then vandalize her. You know, again, think about that from, you know, think about that from a
oh,
another
yeah.
type of filmic cliche. The hoods surround the girl, you know, the hood, the main hood gets
and
in her face,
take turns.
Scares her, and then they beat the crap out of her. And then what's the follow-up to that? The follow-up to that is, you know, the next day, Arnie and Lee go to Darnell's, and he walks in, and he sees her all mangled up. And it's like, of course, it's the exact same scene you would get if the girl was actually attacked. You'd see the scene of the boyfriend or the husband or whomever coming upon her and seeing her laid to waste there. You know.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's more than an attack. There's a whole subtext of rape to it. You know.
Exactly.
And then afterwards, when he's talking about it, he's like, you know, somebody took a dump on her seat. You know, one of them took a dump on her seat. You know.
It's that idea. It's the attack and the humiliation and the and then it plays on the helplessness feeling of the boyfriend in this case. And it's like, that's, you know, if this was shot with, you know, if Christine was a girl and not a car, you know, it would be almost a cliche to shoot it like this, but because she's a car, you know, it's novel. You know, it's the same type of, you know, it's this pretty basic sort of film, you know, approach to filming this sort of thing, but it's a car. You know,
it was like when they attacked the old man and his wife in A Clockwork Orange, you know, they actually toy with the car a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
The guy gets up on top of her and he swings his bat around, you know, and, you know, they all put on a big they're basically terrorizing the car first, you know.
Yeah. And she tries to fight back. She plays the radio and all that, and Mucci smashes it out, and which is, you know, like the little wormy guy, he'd always punch the girl in the mouth or something. So you know, it's like, and so at that point, you know, again, even if you don't know it's coming, you want Mucci to get friggin' crushed. You want Buddy Repperton to get run over. You know, you want those hoods to die. They're, you know, we don't feel bad for anybody she kills, except maybe Darnell, you know.
But the whole Buddy Repperton character in this reminds me so much of the John Travolta character in
Carrie,
yes.
Yeah.
The sort of long-haired 70s, you know, douchebag guy, you know, jockey, bully sort of character, and he even looked like him, you know, and he just beat up the car instead of dumping pig blood on him. But they had the same sort of, maybe because they're Stephen King characters, that relish of being, you know, evil and,
they took pride in making others miserable.
Yes, pride and joy in it, and I noticed that was a big similarity. Although there were a few years between, I think, Carrie and Christine.
Yeah.
Once Brian De Palma comes up again.
Brian De Palma, another auteur, filmmaker known for his work in the horror genre.
Yeah, and I would someday the three of us are going to just have to get together off air and come up with a master list of everything. Maybe we should all just individually come up with our lists of the movies that we want to do and then get them all together, because I wouldn't mind doing some Brian De Palma movies.
Yeah,
yeah, that's an area that I'm woefully lacking in knowledge of.
I got my nose into a lot of Brian De Palma stuff when I was young too, and that was all sex and violence too.
So I'm in.
Some fond memories of that, yeah. Oh, I suggest for you, Hero, Body Double.
Yeah.
That's okay.
But okay, I would say next time, when that happens, we will be talking about John Carpenter's The Fog, and certainly, I don't recommend it to the other two, but I might even watch the remake just to see. I will definitely not watch the remake until after I've seen the original John Carpenter, but I just may watch the remake just to compare the two of them, or to maybe I'll be
a better word, I think.
Maybe I might be able to get an episode of The Media Masochist out of it. So it might turn out for the good.
Yeah.
But until then, we'll see you guys later.
And Depth to the Shitters of the World in 1979.
Yeah. Oh my god, we got through this whole show and none of us said shitters. Oh, I'm so ashamed. Well, we said it before we started this, before we ended the last show, we mentioned shitters. Damn! Yeah. Shitters, 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 shitters. There. Make up for it. I'm in love with my car.
Did you know? You can sponsor an episode of this or any other of your favorite Two True Freaks affiliated shows. That's right. Simply click the PayPal link on our website, donate any amount at all, tell us which show you're choosing and what message, if any, you'd like us to read on your behalf, and you will be an official sponsor of that show's very next episode, with your message read in the show's opener. It's that easy, and there is no minimum donation. Be a show sponsor today.
Visit our website at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com. Twotruefreaks.libsyn.com is spelled twotruefreaks.libsyn, which is libsyn.com.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
You can find me, Scott Gardner, both on Twitter and Facebook. My name is spelled Scott Gardner. Two True Freaks is a very proud member of the League of Comic Book Podcasts. For more information, visit comicbooknoise.com/league.
We are also members of the Comics Podcast Network. You can check it out at www.comicspodcasts.com, where you can hear our new episodes when we put them up. Thanks for listening.
Join us every Monday for new episodes of Two True Freaks.
Two True Freaks has been brought to you today by Damanzo Core of Milan, Italy, and by the letters F and U.